You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, roads, bridges, sidewalks, and bike paths are among the more than 150 local transportation projects that Wisconsin awarded grant money to last week. We talked to a roadway expert about the projects within a bigger transportation picture. Now, oil prices have plunged worldwide as two of the world's top oil producers face off in a dispute over oil production. The fight is between Saudi Arabia and Russia. It could mean lower gas prices for consumers at the pump, and it could be bad news for petroleum producers in the U.S. Jim Ritterbusch is an energy analyst with the firm Ritterbusch & Associates based in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you put this oil price drop into context for us? How big is this?
It's a big deal, and we have not seen the lows by any stretch of the imagination in terms of prices, either in crude futures or at the pump. So we have further to fall, and this is a result of developments just within the past 3 days in which the two powerhouses, Russia and Saudi Arabia, have gone head-to-head. And this is emanated from Russia dropping out of the what we call the OPEC Plus alliance. And that was followed within a couple of days by the Saudis indicating that they were basically going to open the spigots and increase production, and in conjunction with that, they reduced their official selling prices to their major consumers, such as the United States, China, et cetera.
Yeah, let's dig into that backstory just a little bit more. So you've got Saudi Arabia and OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries. They produce a lot of oil, obviously. Russia does, too. The initial negotiations were them trying to agree, right, to lower production to keep prices up. Do I have that right?
You have that right. They had a viable deal operating for about 2 or 3 years, where Russia agreed back about 2017 to cooperate with OPEC and restraining production, and that worked for a long time. It boosted prices and until the coronavirus thing came along, that was a viable strategy for them. But at the same time that they were restraining their output, they were relinquishing market share to U.S. Shale producers.
Yeah, let's get to the U.S. In just a couple. But you mentioned coronavirus, and that injected itself into this story because what? Energy demand was going down because of coronavirus in China and then elsewhere?
Energy demand is not only going down, it's plunging. And that prompted the Saudis to suggest a very extreme measure in which they would cut output collectively by about 1.5 million barrels a day. So the demand deterioration that we're seeing off of the virus is very difficult to assess. And we don't know what the end result will be. But as long as the virus continues to spread, the market's plugging in a worst-case scenario in which we're going to see a dramatic drop in demand that will increase global oil inventories considerably.
Talking to Jim Ritterbusch, energy analyst, about this big drop in oil prices amid a dispute between Saudi Arabia and Russia. And Jim, let's bring this on home now. The United States emerged as, what, the top petroleum producer over the last couple of decades. What is this going to mean for these businesses that have, you know, changed the face of places like North Dakota and gotten bigger out in Texas and elsewhere around the country?
There's going to be some pain there. And the shale producers and Texas, Oklahoma, for instance, they're going to be faced with some sizable problems. There's going to be bankruptcy. A lot of companies have big debt loads. A lot of companies very highly leveraged, and it's going to be a drastic scramble for capital. And as a result, the production will begin to slide. And that's partially the objective of both Saudi Arabia and Russia. But in the meantime, it's going to mean a fair amount of pain in the U.S. Oil sector.
Is it just cheaper for me to pump oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia than it is for me to do, you know, hydraulic fracturing or what people call fracking here in the United States?
Absolutely. You're probably looking at a difference between $45 in the U.S. and maybe $20 in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia can withstand these much lower oil prices for a significant amount of time before somebody cries uncle. And as a result, this looks like we're going to see additional price slippage here, which will be good news at the pump anyway.
We're not a big oil-producing state here in Wisconsin, but we do have this sand. People call it frac sand that gets used a lot in hydraulic fracking. It's been an up-and-down market as fashions change and where people want to get their sand from and how far they want to ship it. But that said, if there's a decline in this fracking around the country, does that have an impact on the states like Wisconsin that produce the sand that they use in it?
Absolutely. There's already been a surplus of sand, which some of the Wisconsin sand producers have had to contend with. And that problem will only be exacerbated by this plunge in oil prices. And that'll continue or sustain a trend in which a lot of sand mining has been developing closer to the producing regions.
Let's get to that price at the pump you just mentioned there. How much does a big drop in the per barrel price of oil translate into lower prices when we fill up our tanks?
Oh, I'm not sure how much it's already come off in one day. Some gasoline stations are very sensitive. They even have futures quotes that they watch on their phones every day. So we're going to see some immediate price declines, I think, and ultimately we could see 25 cents, maybe 30 cents shaved off of retail gasoline prices as this month proceeds. So you're going to see some sub-$2 pump prices in a lot of areas of the country here, possibly in short order.
That's some savings for consumers, but this this weird big drop in oil prices seems to be making the stock markets drop even more than they already were over fears of coronavirus. How do you weigh the net impact on the economy of a change like this?
Well, it's difficult to balance one against the other, but the energy sector is a major sector of the U.S. economy. It's probably 8 or 9% in total, and that may not sound like a lot, but it feeds off of other industries. Spending on energy, for instance, is a huge driver of heavy industrial equipment, manufacturing, and things like that. So that's going to feed off into other areas, and that's one reason that the stock market became spooked and the Dow dropped by about 2,000 points today.
Jim, say this low price continues for a while and it leads to, as you mentioned, possible bankruptcies of the oil producing companies here in the United States. Eventually, the oil price might go back up. How easy is it for the U.S. After a lot of shakeouts to, pick up an oil industry again after, a short term, maybe disaster like this for businesses?
Well, some of the questions I get relate to whether it's going to be a V-shaped recovery or not. And I see this as more of an L-shaped recovery, where it's going to take a while to get the industry back on its feet. Boosting prices as a result of reduced supply or reduced production tends to be a slow mover. So that factor will ultimately accommodate placing a bottom in the oil market, but it's not going to immediately force a major upswing. And if I'm correct in that assumption, we could be looking at a very slow recovery in the U.S. Economy once the coronavirus factor shakes out and once supply gets down to a level where it becomes price supportive.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jim Ritterbush, energy analyst with the firm Ritterbush & Associates based in Galena, Illinois. He was with us today to talk about the latest on oil prices and a big standoff between two of the world's biggest oil producers, Saudi Arabia and Russia, and how it affects things here in the United States. Coming up, we'll ask what you look for as the first official sign of spring. You can get the conversation going early by posting on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Your comments and calls in just a bit coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's still snow and ice covering much of the state, but spring isn't too far off. We want to know what you look for as the first sign of spring. Whether it's a plant, an animal, a sporting event, or anything else, let us know. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your personal first sign of spring. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Maureen McCollum takes us to an outdoor hockey tournament.
Wisconsinites know how to make the most of the winter, and they can roll with the punches when weather misbehaves. Both acts were on display at this year's Door County Pond Hockey Tournament. Athletes traveled from across the region to play hockey outside in the middle of winter, but quickly worked together when they had to move the games. WPR's Megan Hart brings us their story.
It's a sunny Saturday afternoon in February, and the Door County Pond Hockey Tournament is in full swing. Teams came from across the Midwest to play at the event. Spirits were high, even though the weather threw a wrench in the plans. It was too warm and wet this year to hold the Door County Pond Hockey Tournament on a pond. Fortunately, tournament organizers found the next best thing. The event usually takes place on Kangaroo Lake. This year, it was moved to the Sister Bay Sports Complex.
We came up with this location about a week and a half ago.
Brian Fitzgerald started the tournament 7 years ago. He says it took hundreds of hours to get the new venue playable, and it wouldn't have happened without the community's help.
And, I mean, even on Monday, we were out here working in T-shirts, and it was a concrete slab, and it was a little disheartening, thinking, okay, how are we going to pull this off?
Fitzgerald says the rinks this year are smaller than on Kangaroo Lake, but they got positive reviews from players. That includes former NHLer Dave Mackey. He played for the Chicago Blackhawks, Minnesota North Stars, and St. Louis Blues. In Door County, he represents the TL Redhawks.
We're the 2018 defending champions, by the way.
It was the fourth time Mackey and his teammates traveled from Chicago's northern suburbs to play in the tournament.
Ice conditions have been good here, so it's been fun. We just try to zip the puck around and have a little fun. And no checking and try not to get hurt.
Pond hockey is a little different than the game you might recognize. In pond hockey, there's no goalie. Most tournaments use a short wooden goal with openings in the corners instead of a regular net. Ben Weisberger says the conditions level the playing field.
So obviously the ice is just a lot rougher, so you got to just be prepared to fall down when you're skating around. It doesn't matter how good of a skater you are. And then it's also just a lot more just throwing the puck at the net, getting pucks to the net, just crash the net hard, which is what we like to do.
Weisberger plays for a team from Chicago called Upper Bunk.
The top bed of a bunk bed where you sleep at night, that's also where we consider shooting at top shelf, so that's why we go Upper Bunk.
What about here where there's not a net?
We still go upper bunk. We only score Upper Bunk.
That's why we lose every game.
The team names get creative. There's Puck Norris, the Hat Trick Swayzes, and Hawaii Five Hole. It's the first time playing in the tournament for Morgan Menting from Green Bay. Her team is called Zero Pucks Given.
We started a group messenger, and we went for a name, and that's what came up.
The Cream City Brickhands came from Milwaukee.
The Milwaukee area, Cream City, yep. And we're also terrible, so Brickhands obviously put that in there, so yeah.
They started the day 0-2, but Casey Monier says it didn't stop them from having fun.
This is just unbelievable. The conditions are good out here, so we really are enjoying it.
Alex Wirtz and his teammates traveled from Chicago to play in the fresh air.
We're the Rats. Rat hockey, rink rat. Chicago has a lot of rats, and just stuck, right?
He'd broken his skate earlier in the day. His teammate, Colin Salisbury, was impressed that tournament organizers had found an extra pair so that Wirtz could still play.
That's pretty amazing. Two pairs of skates for a guy that broke skates, so you can't beat Northern hospitality.
Wirtz says it's this warm reception that keeps the rats coming back. That and the prime rib and old fashions at Glidden Lodge in Sturgeon Bay.
Wisconsin's a great state, a lot of nice people, a lot of good beer up here, a lot of good food, and we just enjoy ourselves. So it's a nice trip to bring all the boys together and, you know, get up to Door County and see what all it has to offer.
Megan Hart brought us that story on the Door County Pond Hockey Tournament. She's WPR's sports reporter based in Green Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, some of Wisconsin saw temperatures in the 50s yesterday, and we had to spring our clocks ahead for daylight savings time. It almost feels like spring is on the way. Official spring starts on March 19th, but everyone has their own idea of when we can put winter safely in the rearview mirror. We want to know, what do you consider the first sign of spring? Call in at 800-642-1234. Maybe it's an animal or plant that shows up. Maybe it's an event in your neighborhood or something from the world of sports. Whatever spells spring to you, let us know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jude is with us in Iola. Jude, hi.
Hi. Well, last week, I'm always looking for the migrating birds and always looking for the hibernators. And last week, I saw my first chipmunk. And 4 days ago in Milwaukee, I saw my first robin.
All right.
And today in Iola, I saw two sandhill cranes.
Oh, that's a great sign. That's exciting to see the sandhills.
So absolutely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, did you celebrate seeing all these guys?
Oh, I love nature more than anything, so I'm always looking for that. But I do have my daffodils are about they're coming up. They're about 4 inches tall, but they of course haven't flowered yet. So that's another sign of spring for me.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jude, so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. We heard from Nancy on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nancy says also the return of the sandhill cranes and red-winged blackbirds. They arrived last week. And we heard from Lynn on Facebook who says her sign is the smell of dirt. I know what you mean, that spring damp sort of smell. Things are starting to grow. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Artis now in Dousman. Artis, hi.
Hi. Well, the first sign of spring for me is rain and mushy snow.
Yeah. And do you like getting out for a hike in that, Artis?
Absolutely not.
Me neither. It gets warm like this weekend and I get tempted and I think there's going to be enough ice for me to slide down and fall in the mud that's on the other side of the ice. You avoid that too?
Yeah, I try to.
Artis, thank you so much for that call. We are looking for your signs of spring. We heard from Mary on Facebook and also Dan Robinson from Simply Folk and Dean Kallenbach from Eau Claire Bureau, who all said tapping maple trees. And word on the street anyway is that the sap is running now, so we can look forward to some fresh maple syrup hopefully coming before too long. Also heard from Malcolm Brett. It's a name I haven't heard in a good long time. Former director of Wisconsin Public Media, who says pitchers and catchers, the first players reporting for baseball's spring training. Well, back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Oop, the caller is going to go to dropped, but more callers are coming in again at 800-642-1234. Molly Stentz from The Morning Show, executive producer there, says she looks forward to the sound of spring peepers. When you hear those little frogs singing, you know spring is coming. And Robert on Facebook said his sign of spring is attending No Brand Con. That's an anime convention in Wisconsin Dells in April. Well, that's a later start to spring, but I respect that if you've got that annual spring tradition. Back to your calls now. Larry is with us in Star Prairie. Larry, hello.
Hello.
What's your sign of spring, Larry?
I've got a little pothole behind my house, and when the little spring peepers are starting to peep.
Okay.
That's when I know it's spring.
Are they peeping yet this year?
No, it's still froze over.
Oh, okay. When do you usually hear them, Larry, do you figure?
God, it's been a while, but I've heard them when there's still a little ice on it, but it's going to be a while yet. There's still plenty of snow. Things are still froze over around here.
Now, when the freeze is done and you hear the spring peepers, are you able to see them too, or are they too reclusive to get a lot of sightings?
Oh, they're pretty sneaky, but yeah. But no, I enjoy listening to them. It's a beautiful sound.
Larry, thanks so much for that. We'll go now to Gwen with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. My first sign of spring that I saw yesterday driving back to Madison from Wausau was the ducks are moving. They're starting to migrate back north.
That's exciting. Did you see a whole flock of them or just some kind of early adventurers?
They were medium-sized flocks. I saw two of them.
Fantastic. That's a good sign. Thanks for that, Gwen. We'll go to Jody now in Exonia. Jody, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm calling because we have sandhill cranes. Have had them for 3 or 4 days flying overhead now. And we have the turkey vultures who always return about mid-March, and they are here.
So it's officially spring, you're calling it, Jody?
It's officially spring.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
When the vultures return, yep. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for that call. Peter Sobel from our technology team says, not all parks take their volleyball nets down in the fall, but when those that do, put them back up again. I know spring is here. Paul Damberg from our Superior Bureau director there says, when the ice on the street melts from curb to curb. Time for another caller, I think. Joy is with us in Elgin, Illinois. Joy, hello.
Hi, calling from Elgin. My sign of spring is when my postal carrier starts wearing shorts and the UPS guys wear shorts. And I also had two little yellow crocuses come up.
The crocuses are coming up. Are the shorts out yet, though, Joy? Seems a little early to me.
No. My carrier had shorts on.
Oh, already?
Today, hopefully, she has her rain gear on.
I hope so.
But on Saturday, when she came, she had shorts on. I saw her knees.
Wow, that is a sure sign of spring. Joy, thank you so much. Thanks to everybody for your calls. You can keep posting your signs of spring, and whether you've seen them yet in spring 2020, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, Governor Evers announced $75 million in grants for various types of local transportation improvement projects around the state. We'll find out how they fit into the state's larger transportation funding picture. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for an update on the shooting at the Molson Coors facility in Milwaukee with ongoing questions about the motives of the perpetrator and efforts to help the community recover. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Governor Tony Evers was in Brown County last Wednesday talking about the importance of safe, reliable ways to get from point A to point B. He announced the awarding of roughly $75 million in 152 grants for projects around the state that would facilitate multiple modes of transportation. That list of projects includes $1 million going to improvements to the Howard-Suamico area.
The grant we're announcing today will be used to widen and improve Lineville Road and add sidewalks, bike lanes, and controlled pedestrian crossing. This will not only alleviate rush hour traffic and congestion, but keep drivers safe, but it'll also help our kids and their parents get to school and home safely every single day.
Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss responded to the announcement of the grants with frustration that the governor wasn't using the money the way he and his colleagues had intended. In a statement, Voss said, quote, "It's disappointing that 100% of the money isn't going to local roads as intended. Instead, millions of dollars are being diverted to bike paths and buses, with fewer dollars available to help crumbling roads." Dan Federle is executive director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association. He's a registered professional engineer and land surveyor and served as highway commissioner for the St. Croix County Highway Department from 1990 to 2003. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Very good. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, we've been hearing about this $75 million grant program passed by the legislature, and now the winners have been announced. But can you put it in perspective for us? $75 million sounds like a lot of money. How does it fit in terms of how much we spend overall on roads in the state?
Well, it does sound like a lot of money, but in total, it's a small percentage of the overall expenditure when we include state highways, county highways, town roads, both state and federal funds and local funds. And it's also a small percentage of the needs on the system, as demonstrated by the this grant process in itself. $75 million is certainly welcome. It certainly will be put to good use on the local system. But given that we had in something in excess of $1.4 billion in applications, and those were just applications, that doesn't even identify all the needs on the system, you can see that the $75 million is just a small percentage of the actual needs that we have on the local system in Wisconsin.
Now, getting a little technical in where funding comes from, this $75 million was from our general budget, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Most of our money comes from a separate transportation spending pocket that is separate from the state budget. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it comes out of the transportation fund that is funded largely with gas tax registration fees. And then also it comes from the federal government in terms of the federal gas tax that people pay at the pumps when they fill up.
Now, we heard on our Facebook page, Alan wrote, local governments by law are responsible for at least 70% of the funding. In my opinion, we should not depend on state or federal funding, but find ways to fund more locally. How do we divide the funding up between that local government, a county government, versus what the state puts in?
Well, generally speaking, the local governments, that's property tax. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we also have a need, an obligation, if you will, to address the property tax and how we can keep that as sustainable as well as reasonable and affordable for our people in the state. And so subsequently, when we look at local funding, there's a few options short of property tax, wheels tax, things of that nature that allow the locals to generate those funds locally. Having said that, for the most part, you're going to see the majority, whether it's at the town or county level, the majority of their funding, or at least a significant portion of their funding, does come locally and is generated through property tax revenues. In some cases, you'll find that the counties have implemented a wheel tax that's gotten more attention here over the last 4 or 5 years, and there's been more counties that have opted for that choice. But those are the limited resources available to the county at the local level.
And you mentioned this hunger for these grants, a lot more applications than could be met by the $75 million grant program. Are local governments around the state feeling a shortfall in trying to keep up their local roads and other transportation infrastructure?
Absolutely, without question. It's not something that has occurred just recently. It's been a long-term dilemma that local governments have faced. I've referred to several times the Wisconsin County Highway Association surveyed our counties, and we talked about the life cycle of a road. And in typical reconstruction of a county highway, you should be looking at a 50-year life cycle. That road should last you 50 years for every road you rebuild. In our survey, the actual amount of roads being rebuilt, not what they projected, not what they planned, but actually was done in the last 5 years, puts that cycle closer to 150 years. So it's just simply a lack of resources to address the need and the increasing needs on the system.
Talking to Dan Federle with the Wisconsin County Highway Association about transportation spending in Wisconsin, a new $75 million grant program. The winners were just announced. That's just one piece of what goes into roads and other infrastructure in the state. Dan, how do we get there? How do we get to that place where we're so far behind, apparently, at the local transportation spending level?
We need to focus on what can be a long-term sustainable revenue source for transportation. We've looked at numerous studies, numerous options. We can talk about all kinds of different options, but we need to engage in the dialogue to get us to a place where our revenue for transportation lines up with our uses and how we use transportation today. And then the next thing we need to do is, once we have that dialogue and we go forward with a option or combination of options to generate the needed revenue, then we need to also look at innovation. We've the Wisconsin County Highway Association has been a leader in the nation in terms of Everyday Counts, a federal highway initiative to try innovation on a number of different areas. And we have incorporated that into our county roads, our county construction, our county crews, so that we can ensure the taxpayers in Wisconsin that once we do achieve a long-term sustainable revenue source that addresses the needs of the system and how we use our transportation system, that we're providing the best bang for the buck in terms of innovation and how we use those funds as well.
I mentioned concern from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and some other Republicans that not all of this grant money ended up going to just roads. About 20 of the 150 or so projects actually for a combo project, bikes, pedestrian, cars involved in it. Is that a concern you have?
No, that's not. What that does is breaks down largely along political dialogue as opposed to practical dialogue. In today's environment, transportation in Wisconsin is multimodal by every respect. And so subsequently, the needs on the system are multimodal as well. Where the County Highway Association, in a traditional sense, would be considered the road guys, if you will, our commissioners are very well versed in the idea that we have to address each of the modes of transportation in order to generate both the efficiencies and the innovative efforts so that we can make sure that we're getting the biggest bang for the buck. So in other words, by addressing bicycle lanes, bike ped lanes, that can help us in areas in terms of congestion and how we move people. And subsequently, on the overall basis, we're doing the best for transportation in Wisconsin. And so that's bikes versus roads versus transit is purely a political dialogue as opposed to a practical dialogue.
Dan Federle is with us from the Wisconsin County Highway Association, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the biggest need in your part of the state when it comes to transportation funding? What problems do you see? What opportunities? What new things would you like to see? Or is it all about maintaining what's there already where you are? Do you know if you got one of these transportation grants through this multimodal local supplement program? It's called. Love to hear about your local project. Magic wand in your hand. What would you change when it comes to roads, bike paths, mass transit, personal transit in your area? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about local transportation grants and spending on roads and other transportation infrastructure in Wisconsin. We've got with us the Wisconsin County Highway Association Executive Director, Dan Federle. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you need in your part of the state when it comes to transportation? What do you want to see more of, less of? Do you need maintenance? Is there some maintenance that's overdue in your part of the state? Do you work in local government? What are you seeing in your budget? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jen is with us in Williams Bay. Jen, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jen?
I'm really happy you're talking about this. We in Williams Bay, we got one of the grants, and I'm really grateful for a shared bike pedestrian walkway that he was talking about just a minute ago.
Yeah, what was? Tell us about that project, and what do you see as the need for that there, Jen?
Well, it's a country road, and we put a school out there, so the traffic increased like crazy out there. So it made the road really dangerous for pedestrians. And it's been 3 years in the making that we've been trying to do this project, and applying for the grant and actually getting some of the funding towards it really helps to push it through. I'm on the village board, and it's not a popular topic to try and get approved. People on the board want to support roads and infrastructure and, you know, upgrading sewers. They don't automatically want to build in a bike lane or build in a pedestrian pathway. Seems like that's extra for them, and they want to focus on the roads and car traffic more than, you know, putting things out there for pedestrians.
And Jen, you said this is by a school.
Yeah, we've expanded the existing high school to put in the new elementary school out there. So,
Jen, thanks a lot for thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Jen, so Dan, it sounds like, I mean, if you're driving there, that's going to make life easier for you if there is a separate pedestrian bike lane.
That's correct. Jen hit on the exactly the point that we talk about in terms of use of the roadway. There's multi-use in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, just by our geography or the nature of where we're at, we have to facilitate transportation in a lot of different areas. And so subsequently, the use of funds to help facilitate bike and pedestrian use is something that helps in terms of the highways. Although it may not be funding a road, it is still helping offset the costs that would be imperative in terms of safety and how we design that road in the future with the increased bike pedestrian traffic.
Jen, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I don't think the grant thing is a way to... That's not a very fair way to fund it. It sounds like you have to, like, win a contest in order to get your roads fixed. I think the sales tax is really the way to go, because no matter what happens, whether you order online or something's delivered, it's got to come down your road, either FedEx or UPS or other delivery. And so it's having an impact on your roads. So they should have a sales tax dedicated to transportation. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. The idea there, yeah, sales tax to help the roads, Dan.
Yeah, Jimmy, hits the nail on the head there. That's what I talk about in terms of long-term sustainable revenue sources and how we need to look at alternatives that are more commensurate with how we use our system. He points out exactly the point. A great deal of online purchasing, packages being delivered, road use. We need the roads to get the packages there. Let's look at how we tie that together with a long-term sustainable revenue source. And that's not the only solution, but it becomes one of a menu of options that we need to look at in terms of funding the transportation system.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dom is with us in Madison. Dom, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I was just driving from Richmond Center back to Madison, and road maintenance is definitely a high priority. But a couple other things, there's a lot of development around Madison, where north of Madison, where the farmland's being turned into communities, and I don't see the roads being keeping up with that. And then the third quick point is, I would really love to have a train, a passenger train that goes from Madison to Milwaukee to Chicago to the Twin Cities, and stop using the roads when they don't need to be used.
Dom, thanks a lot for that call. Check out the WPR podcast Derailed to hear more about passenger rails rise and fall that might have done that. But Dan, that idea that Dom said, that, hey, we might have communities springing up in a suburban area and the roads don't keep up with it. Is that something you see happening?
Yep, that's a ramification of the limited resources at the local level in terms of generating the needed revenue. And so subsequently, the development, if you will, if we want to call that in a broadest sense development, happens faster than our ability to generate the revenue. And so subsequently, the roads lag behind as one of the main items that needs to be upgraded. In terms of the passenger train, I would just point out that currently there is the Hiawatha, and it is one of the most successful passenger routes in the nation right now in terms of ridership and funding.
Dom, thanks for that call. Let's go back to our callers now. Marvin is with us in Judah. Marvin, hello.
Hi. I'd like to speak about the funding highway repair. Right now, we've got a significant number of electric vehicles out here and very high fuel efficient vehicles. And it seems to me like they're not paying their proper use. They're not. Some of them are paying almost no gas taxes. If we were to charge a mileage use, depending on how far a person drives per year, and tax them on that, I think we would fuel would fund our roads just a little better, and we're going to have a lot more electric vehicles in the future, is my understanding.
Marvin, thanks a lot for that call. Is that a concern, Dan, if we're, you know, having a gallon, you know, per gallon tax on gas to pay for our roads and cars are more fuel efficient and use little or even no gas? Is that part of our funding trouble?
Yeah, absolutely. Your listeners are hitting on each of the points when we talk about that long-term prospect and the need to address how we generate revenue in relationship to how we use the system. Certainly, a vehicle mile traveled, VMTs as they call it, is a one of the options that we've looked at as well, and we continue to look at. I believe personally that that's one of the better options, because as a VMT, you can adjust that based on what kind of vehicle it is. Heavy trucks, possibly they pay more. And then you start to address the hybrids, the electric vehicles. And so subsequently, from a fairness standpoint, everybody begins to pay towards the system in a fairer manner, if you will.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marvin. We're talking to Dan Federle from the Wisconsin County Highways Association. We are looking at the state of transportation infrastructure in Wisconsin and what goes into paying for it. I want to go back to our Ideas Network Facebook page comments. Janelle wrote, fill the potholes and make sure chunks don't fall from the bridges. Janelle looking for the basics here. Do we have a sense of just the overall condition, Dan, of our roads and bridges in the state?
Well, as of recent studies, the system has shown a decline from, say, 10 years ago. That decline is relative specific to the lack of funding or the lack of our ability to address a long-term sustainable revenue source. But I would say that as we work towards the programs that we're talking about today with the multimodal supplement program, and as we continue to work on innovative efforts on how we make the best use of those funds, we can begin to work on addressing the condition of the system. The decline of the system didn't happen overnight or in one term or two terms. It happened over a period of time. And so subsequently, our ability to address that decline will be over a period of time as well.
Time for one more caller. Patricia is on the line in Spring Green. Patricia, hello.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to comment on the pick up on one of the earlier callers' comments about the importance of multimodal and particularly rail. And one thing is the link between economic development and the fact that so many small communities in Wisconsin are losing population. And yes, they can't be brought closer to a city, but in a way, a train could ensure that people in smaller communities could get to jobs in larger cities and back home, and then that seniors could stay in their communities because they'd have transportation even after they don't drive. So just wondering, I know the state...
Patricia, I'm going to jump in. We just have a few moments left. Dan, in our last 30, 40 seconds or so, the link between that kind of transportation and our economic development.
Well, I think that's a key point. I think that's the whole idea of multimodal and how we address transportation in the state. We need to address all the areas. We can't focus on one versus the other, certainly. We cannot pit one mode against another mode. We need to address the needs of the citizens and how we move transportation throughout the state, whether it be elderly, whether it be electric, whether it be freight movements, whether it be passenger rail, whether it be bike ped. It all has to work uniformly in order to achieve the best system that we can achieve.
Patricia, thanks for the call. And Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Very good. I appreciate the opportunity very much. Thank you.
That's Dan Federle, Executive Director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association. We talked to him today about the $75 million in local transportation grants announced by Governor Evers last week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a speaker coming to Wisconsin tells us how we can help prevent gender violence in American society. We'll take a look at Wisconsin's immigration history and some of the lessons from the last two centuries that could still apply to the state today. And from quilting to pottery, metalworking to printmaking, the author of a new book captures the joy of making things by hand, and you can share your experiences. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, a lot of people deal with back pain and headaches. Sometimes there's a connection between the two. Kate talks to an expert on chronic pain prevention and treatment. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then having a civil conversation with people you disagree with can be tough. We'll learn about a group launched in Wisconsin that's bringing people together to talk about the issues and understand each other a little better along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.